Well, so our challenge is also to try to show how wrong are the messages of the false solutions. I wanted to show you this slide. And that we have to fight against these wrong messages that are being posed and keep fighting to promote the real solutions and protect them for the expansion of this agri-fuels business that is threatening the southern countries and making impossible for them to keep alive their social and biodiversity. Thank you.
Lucia Ortiz. You're listening to a panel on false solutions to the problem of energy from Confronting the Triple Crisis, a conference held last September in Washington, D.C. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We'll continue with the next speaker, Tony Clark. He's the director of the Polaris Institute in Canada, which works with citizen movements to develop tools and strategies for challenging corporate power and public policymaking on key issues, both nationally and internationally. At present, this work includes both energy and water issues. On energy, he's actively involved in developing national and U.S.-related campaigns to stop the massive Canadian tar sands production, which has become the number one source of foreign oil imports to the U.S., which his presentation will address.
I just want to begin by saying that last night we heard a lot about oil addiction and that this is a major problem which has to be faced here in the United States, that we are dealing with the problems of peak oil and the end of cheap oil, that we are also moving from an era where it was easy to get at oil and petroleum underground, and we are now in that period where we are in the hard-to-get-at resources and raw materials dealing with oil itself. At the same time, as we move into the hard-to-get-at, we are running into massive hazardous situations, hazards that have to do with the ecology, social hazards, and political hazards that are created as a result of what is happening with regards to the hard-to-get-at resources underneath the Earth's crust. And one of the stories that we can lift up and address at this point in time happens to be the story of the Canadian tar sands, which are located and developed in the province of Alberta in Canada. Okay, here we have the situation where, and by the way, the fueling there, there's two L's, that's a Canadian spelling. I know you spell it with one L, so I want to make sure that nobody nails me for that right off the bat. But the U.S. oil addiction that we were talking about, the question is, who's fueling that? Where is the fueling coming from? And we know that the U.S. is responsible for over 25% of the world's oil consumption. We know that 20 to 22 million barrels of oil are consumed every day here in the United States. We also know that 58% of that oil is that the U.S. needs is imported, brought into the country now from around the world, whereas back in the early 70s, you were pretty well self-sufficient in oil. That is not the case now. And we know that something like anywhere between 12 and as high as 14 million barrels of oil are imported every day for U.S. consumption. So the question is, who is the number one foreign supplier of oil to the United States today? Is it Saudi Arabia? Is it Nigeria? Venezuela? Caspian Sea? Ecuador? Bolivia? Colombia? No! It's good old Canada. So what we are dealing with in terms of the Canadian tar sands is the one of the largest hydrocarbon deposits ever discovered on this planet. We're dealing with a deposit that has somewhere between 175 and 200 billion barrels of proven oil reserves using conventional technologies that we presently have in place. As I said before, there are three major deposits, the Athabasca, the Cold Lake, and the Peace River area. But geologists also indicate that if we come up with new technologies, it's quite possible that there are 2.5 billion barrels of oil underneath this whole area itself. We are, at the present time, Canada exports to the United States 2.2 billion barrels. About 1.2 billion is million. Pardon me, 2.2 million barrels a day. Of that, of which 1.2 million is actually coming from the tar sands itself. And when we look at the current situation, and this is the thing to keep in mind throughout this presentation, is that back in January in Houston, January 2006 in Houston, there was a meeting between our two governments, Canada and the United States, plus the major oil companies, in which a set of demands was put forward by Washington calling for a five-fold increase in the amount of oil coming from the tar sands to the United States. So we are potentially looking at somewhere between 5 and 6 million barrels of oil being shipped to the United States between 2015 and 2020. Now, the question is, how is this done? And the primary source is bitumen, which is a black glue similar to asphalt found deep underground. If we look at up here, we see the excavation that goes on and the huge kind of equipment that's used to do that, to produce this kind of bitumen. And there are two processes that are used. One is open pit mining, and the second is in situ processes, which pump the water out using steam, and pump the bitumen out and separate the bitumen from the oil from the bitumen. And this is the process called in situ pumping. And then the bitumen is then upgraded through major upgrader plants and then put in pipelines and sent by pipelines throughout the United States. And we'll come to that in a minute. But basically what we're talking about are three basic sources that are used: a great deal of natural gas, a great deal of water, and a lot of toxic chemicals in this process of creating the oil or generating the oil from the tar sands and the bitumen. Here we have the forest, the boreal forest, the way they are in their natural state before the actual process of tar sands production takes place. Over here we have, I know it may not be all that clear, but there's a huge piece of equipment there, one of the excavating trucks, and you can probably see how big it is in relationship to the people themselves. When you move from there to there, this is the transformation process that takes place. The ripping apart of the strip mining of the forest to produce a moonscape kind of reality over here. And then we look at the fact that 90,000 square miles are a part of that whole area of Alaska, of the Athabasca, the Cold Lake, and the Peace River. 90,000 square miles, which is roughly the size of and the shape in some ways of the state of Florida. That's how big a change and transformation that's taking place through this excavation. If we move to the next slide, we see the fact that there's a great deal of energy that goes into the production of this this oil out of the bitumen. We're looking at the fact that we call this turning gold into lead because a lot of natural gas, clean, a relatively clean fuel like natural gas, is being used to as a part of the whole process itself. If we look at the open pit mining, 750 cubic feet of natural gas is used to produce one barrel of crude oil. And then you add to that the in situ methods that are used, 1,500 cubic feet of natural gas is used to produce one barrel of crude oil. So there's a great deal, and then I'm not even talking about the other aspects and stages of the production, just the actual process of open pit mining and of the in situ process. Over here we see the pipelines that are being envisaged now to bring a natural gas from the Beaufort Sea and from the Arctic down, and or if necessary, putting a spur on and linking into the Alaska pipeline to bring that's designed to bring natural gas down into the southern United States. Both of these processes are underway. The objective is to get natural gas, more natural gas, because the natural gas in conventional reserves is running out rapidly. We have less than around 8.9 years left of natural gas in conventional terms right now. So that's the process that's unfolding. And if that doesn't work, there are nuclear plants that are being planned as well as part of the extraction process that, as a form of energy that will be used. Greenhouse gas emissions that are coming as a result of the tar sands are huge and immense. We are talking about generating massive amounts of greenhouse gases, three times the amount of greenhouse gases that are used for conventional oil production, three times are used in the production of the tar sands. In the production of the tar sands now, 27 million tons a year are produced of greenhouse gases. By the year 2015 to the period to the year 2020, that amount will grow from 27 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions to 126 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions. And they talk about cutting back by 80% below 1990 levels. When you've got that kind of exponential growth taking place, it's absolutely crazy. As a result, obviously, the tar sands have become the number one greenhouse gas emitter as far as Canada is concerned, and contributing greatly to the problems that we are all discussing here more globally today. If we move next to the water slide, we see the water depletion as well taking place at a very rapid rate. It takes somewhere between 2 and 4.5 barrels of water to produce one barrel of oil. And in some cases, that goes as high as 7 barrels of water. And at the same time, we're having major problems in terms of the depletion and the lowering of the Athabasca River, the North Churchill River, and the whole Mackenzie Delta watershed itself is in serious trouble now, largely because of what's happening with the tar sands. And furthermore, toxic chemicals are spewing into the watershed to the point where indigenous peoples, native peoples downstream are faced with and are experiencing some serious problems with regards to their health, and cancer rates are growing at a very rapid rate. As we look at the corporate players that are at the center of this today, and I know with the corporate players, Randy won't ring the bell, that the two major players in Canada that have pioneered this whole tar sands development, Syncrude, which is an alliance of different companies, and Suncor, which is another major company. Both of these companies have spearheaded and pioneered the tar sands development, but now the majors are moving in from the U.S. in big time. So we have ExxonMobil, we have ConocoPhillips, we have Chevron Texaco. And at the same time, two other global players that are moving in, Shell Oil and British Petroleum, are playing big roles now in tar sands production and distribution. This shows you roughly where the various oil leases to the oil companies are. In the center one right here is the is the Athabasca region. The one to the left over here is the Peace River, and the one to the right over here is the Coal Lake. You get an idea of how the companies have staked out their space here, and you're going to see this whole area, that area the size of Florida that I was talking about, is actually going to be under production and is under lease now to these companies in terms of having staked all of this out. If we move here to the whole question of the marketing of tar sands crude, we realize that Chicago and Denver at the present time are the two major ports of receiving the bitumen. Then it is upgraded further into crude oil that can be used and moved to different markets in the states. So there are markets in the Midwest, there are markets in the eastern part of the United States, and increasingly markets are going to be opening up in the western part, even those states that have declared themselves to be on a path of being carbon-free with regards to the future. We're seeing some real problems emerging with regards to the conflict between these states and the whole development that is taking place. The map on the right-hand side here was really produced by some colleagues in Canada, and what it shows is the different places that the oil would be going, the different pipelines that have still in some cases to be developed, and these pipelines are all geared clearly to bring the crude oil to market. And at the same time, what's happening is that we see a great deal of pipeline operations in the northern part of Canada to bring the natural gas down to allow for that production to take place. This is, of course, the U.S. energy program, that is security program, that's largely driving this. Dick Cheney's national energy program calling for increasing dependence upon foreign oil imports. And then where we have a situation of the Canadian crude now becoming the number one supplier with regards to this oil, and number one supplier and fueling of the oil addiction process itself. As I said before, with a five-fold increase, we're looking at potentially 6 million barrels a day coming from Canada to the United States to continue to fuel this process. And then finally, I'm just going to wrap this up really quick by the fact that these guaranteed Canadian exports are, if you may think that China's going to get it, China wants it, China's trying to get in there, but it won't get in there under the current, the current collaboration is set up between Canada and the United States. We have the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Proportionality Clause, which calls on us to keep exporting at an increasing rate. And secondly, we have the Security and Prosperity Partnership that was referred to briefly last night, and particularly the Resource Security Pact, which will lock in and guarantee an ongoing supply of these resources. This is clearly a nightmare solution. The Canadian tar sands is not only a false solution, it's a nightmare scenario. And it's going to exacerbate the triple crisis in three ways: by consolidating the U.S. oil dependence and fossil fuel future, thereby denying the warnings of global peak oil. Secondly, by intensifying global warming trends through ever-expanding greenhouse gas emissions and high levels of net energy loss. And thirdly, depleting and destroying other vital natural resources such as water and the boreal forests. And finally, just want you to all know that this is not going away without a great deal of resistance. We are seeing major resistance now beginning to develop in the province of Alberta, spreading in different parts of Canada as well. And we're going to see this campaign begin to grow and develop. And then secondly, we are clearly seeing some cross-border collaboration and development of cross-border strategies of resistance, and more of that's going to happen in the future. And I want to say finally that we are not only in the situation of saying to ourselves, we've got to bring an end to this, we've got to roll back this kind of development, We've got to come up with a new model of development, and we're looking at, in many cases, what the Aboriginal peoples are outlining in the northern part of Canada and bringing that forward as a vision for the future. And we call it, along with borrowing a phrase from some other groups, changing the dream. And that's what I think this is all about. We are about the task of changing the dream and getting rid of the nightmare. So that's the story of the Canadian tar sands.
Tony Clark.
Now, it's my pleasure to introduce Mary Ann Hitt, who is the executive director of Appalachian Voices and who has done a tremendous job of leadership with regards to working with many different groups, in taking on this huge development that is taking place in the Appalachian area or region. She is focused in many ways on the whole ecological impacts and what's happening with the Appalachian Mountains and the strip mining that is taking place there. And what's wonderful about it is that Mary Ann grew up in the Appalachian Mountain area and therefore speaks very authentically about what is happening there. And I remember seeing her make a presentation almost a year ago in San Francisco, and I was wowed by it, and I think you will be too. So, Mary Ann Hitt, please welcome.
My name is Mary Ann Hitt. I am the executive director of Appalachian Voices, and our mission is to bring people together to solve the big environmental problems facing the central and southern Appalachian Mountains. And before I start, I want to acknowledge that three people who are some of my great heroes in the fight to end mountaintop removal are here, and I would like for them to stand up. And one is Lenny Combe, the campaign director of Appalachian Voices. One is Judy Bonds, who is the winner of the 2003 Goldman Prize. And the co-director of Coal River Mountain Watch in the coal fields of southern West Virginia. And the third is Alan Johnson, co-founder of Christians for the Mountains in West Virginia. Mountaintop removal mining, I'm going to tell you what it is, what the impacts are, and where it's happening, and why those of us who are working on it are very concerned about clean coal. Mountaintop removal mining is a form of mining where instead of taking the coal out of the mountain, they take the mountain off the coal. The coal is in the mountain, kind of like layers in a cake, and what they do is they drill holes, they fill them with explosives, and blow the mountains up, and shovel everything that's not coal over the side. They take that rock and they bury the streams, and to date, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 miles of streams have been buried, 1 million acres have been destroyed, over 470 mountains have been blown up in 4 states. This is done by huge equipment that does the job that was normally done by many hundreds of people. This is a drag line that is over 20 stories high. And once the coal has been removed, they have to remove everything that isn't coal, and they wash it with all these toxic chemicals, and this sludge that they leave behind is stored in earthen dams, hundreds of them all throughout Appalachia, some of which are larger than the Hoover Dam. Oops. And then the coal is shipped out to provide electricity for all of us. Half of our electricity in this country comes from coal, and we'll hear more about that from Jeff. So there are about 8 major impacts of mountaintop removal that I want to run over with you briefly. And the first is it's a major environmental justice issue. It's happening in one of the poorest regions of the country. It's wiping out entire communities and entire culture. And that's why I bet you $20 that the back of Judy's shirt says "Save the Endangered Hillbillies." And there's a reason for that. As you can see in this slide, as coal production has stayed pretty high in West Virginia, the mining jobs have been on a serious decline. Again, this is highly automated, and you'd think with all of this great wealth in West Virginia, the streets of the coal fields would be paved with gold. But as you would be able to see here if it wasn't all green, It's not red, it's all green. But there's an area in the middle that's sort of splotchy, and those are the mind areas. And the darkest colors here are it overlaps with the poorest areas of, you know, the whole entire Appalachian region, where mountaintop removal is happening, the highest rates of poverty. It also overlaps with the highest rates of unemployment, the lowest levels of high school completion, the lowest per capita income, and it basically, it's hard for me to know what you all are seeing, but it's the one part of our region that's actually losing population. So clearly the great wealth that's coming from this is not benefiting the people who live there by and large. It's also a major environmental health issue. And this is Ed Wiley, who's a grandfather and a former coal miner. And it was actually just about 1 year ago today that he arrived in Washington, D.C. after walking there from Charleston, West Virginia. And he did that walk to raise awareness about the plight of the children in Marsh Fork Elementary School near where Judy lives in southern West Virginia. This is a picture of the school is at the bottom of that sludge dam that you see. And since this picture was taken, most of the mountains around that sludge dam have been blown up. So not only do you have a sludge dam over a school, you have mountains around it that have now been blown up. And so there's more runoff going into that dam. And then you have around the school a lot of coal dust and rock dust that's making the children and the teachers very sick. Clearly then, this is also a major clean water issue. This is a spill in the year 2000 in Martin County, Kentucky, when 300 million gallons of sludge broke through into the Big Sandy River, 30 times bigger than the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Very few people heard about it. And this is happening in the headwaters of the drinking water supply of millions of Americans. It's also, and you can't really see it from the colors, but It's one of the few global biodiversity hotspots that we have here in North America is right here in this exact same region that the mountaintop removal is happening. And it's especially famous for aquatic biodiversity, crayfish, mussels, freshwater fish species. And they are also the most sensitive to all the impacts of mountaintop removal. It's clearly very tied to energy policy, energy use, and climate change. And I know that Jeff is going to talk more about that, but all that carbon dioxide that's in the air warming our planet started out quite a bit of it in the mountains of central Appalachia. And finally, it's a landscape and a land use issue. And if you care about places in this country, then there are a lot of places with coal under them. And if we're willing to blow up some of the oldest mountains on Earth, hundreds of them, you have to fear for all the other places in this country that have coal underneath them. So now I want to talk to you about the scale. This is one mountaintop removal mine. It's huge. It's also very hard to see unless you have the rare opportunity to fly in an airplane over the coal fields of Appalachia. So what we've done, I'm actually going to skip these because you're not going to be able to see the colors, and I'm just going to go right to how we have used Google Earth to try to give people a sense of what is happening. These flags at half mast all mark the locations of mountains that have been blown up by mountaintop removal. And you can see from here, this is an online virtual interactive memorial, how close all this is to the eastern United States. And what you're doing now is you're flying into one mountaintop removal mine. This is the Hobet Mine Complex in southern West Virginia. And you kind of get a sense, more or less, that, yeah, sure, it looks pretty big. There are a lot of mountains that have been blown up there. And so one of the things we've tried to do to give people a sense of the scale is to overlay the Hobet Mine over places in America that people are more familiar with. This is Manhattan in New York, and that's the Hobet Mine. In the memorial, we also gave each one of these mountains their own page with pictures and video and stories, because every single one of these mountains is a real place. Every single one of these mountains is some mountain that somebody looked at from their front porch and where they hiked around when they were a kid and where they showed the wonders of nature to their children. Judy lived on, her family lived on her land for 9 generations before they were forced out. I mean, can you even think about what that's like? How much a place like that is a part of you? And to lose that forever, mountains don't grow back. You can't put a mountain back. When these mountains are gone, they're gone forever. There are hundreds of them gone, and we're trying to tell their stories so that people will understand what's at stake. Just earlier this year, Google put the National Memorial for the Mountains into Google Earth. So anyone who has Google Earth on their computer can go and see these mountains. There's before and after overlays, and you can read the stories. The permanent home of the memorial is a website called ilovemountains.org. It's an online organizing campaign to end mountaintop removal. And Lenny Combe, who's my colleague, I believe is going to be passing around sign-up sheets. So for those of you, I think they're going around, if you'd like to sign up to be part of I Love Mountains and help us stop mountaintop removal, we'd be extremely grateful. The next generation of tools that we're going to launch on I Love Mountains in October, I'm going to give you a little demo of it. This is my house. It's in Blacksburg, Virginia. These are the coal-fired power plants that are on the grid that power my house. And let's take a look at the Glen Lynn power plant, which is run by American Electric Power. What we're going to be able to do with this tool we're going to put on I Love Mountains in October is show you not only the mines that are providing electricity to your power grid, but take you all the way back to the mountains that are being blown up to provide electricity to your house. And if you take a look at where we are right now, it's in southwest Virginia. One of my board members of Appalachian Voices is named Kathy Selvage, and she lives in the middle of this red, horrible-looking area. And when I saw this, and I realized that when I turn on my lights at my house, I was helping to blow up the mountain behind my friend Kathy's house. Even after all that I know about coal and all that I knew about mountaintop removal, I just can't feel the same way about leaving my lights on, and I just can't feel the same way about not doing everything I can to conserve energy. And we're going to have this tool available for everybody in America in October on ilovemountains.org. Just to bring it home here for us, right here in this auditorium, in this lovely audience of people, this is the Hobet Mine over Washington, D.C. You can see it goes all the way, the entire Washington metro area, all the way over to Arlington. Right here in this room, right now, to keep the lights on, to have the air at a comfortable temperature, to show you my beautiful green presentation, 19.8% of the electricity here in Washington comes from the mountaintop removal region. That's not all mountaintop removal coal, but a lot of it that's coming out of the mountaintop removal region is mountaintop removal coal. So we are all connected to this. And that is why we are working to do something about it and why we feel it's a national issue and why we need your help. We have a regional alliance of 13 organizations in Appalachia who are working together on this. We're trying to get the laws enforced. We're trying to pass better laws, including the Clean Water Protection Act, which would stop the dumping of mining waste into streams. And on I Love Mountains, you can write a letter and help us pass the Clean Water Protection Act. We're doing grassroots leadership development in the coal fields, and we're also doing national outreach, speaking tours and I Love Mountains and everything else we can do to help get the word out. And Lenny is actually going to be in California in October, and we're really trying to get some good places for him to speak in California when he's out there. And if anyone has any suggestions or would like to bring us out there in October, we would love to get your help. And so if you want to talk to me afterwards, that would be wonderful. So to close, given all of this, given what people like Judy are living with every day, obviously we're concerned about clean coal. And I'm going to go through 3 concerns that we have. Before I do that, I just want to tell you what is meant by this term clean coal. Clean coal doesn't have anything to do with the mining process. It has to do with the burning process. And generally what people are talking about is gasification and sequestration. Gasification is the way that you burn it. So normally you're basically burning pulverized coal dust in a traditional coal-fired power plant. What they do with gasification is they're heating up the coal and adding some oxygen and creating a gas that they burn instead. Then it's easier in that process to separate out the carbon dioxide. Once they've separated out the carbon dioxide, they have to do something with it, and the idea is it will be put underground or under the floor of the ocean. And there are some IGCC plants out there in existence in the world today, a few. They're much more expensive to build than traditional coal-fired power plants. There is no large-scale sequestration going on today, and people say it's 20 to 30 years out at the best if it's ever going to happen. So given the massive impact of coal mining on our region, our first concern is essentially, I always use this quote of Jeff's in my presentations, and I'm not just doing it because he's here and I want to impress him or anything. I also always tell every audience I speak to that you need to read his book, Big Coal. I think it's one of the most important environmental books that's out there today. And I'm also not just saying that because he's here. But I really do believe that. And I think his point is very concisely put here, that this is a giant carbon anchor that's slowing down the transition to cleaner forms of energy. And if you look at this next slide from American Electric Power presentation that they gave, they see gasification as a way to keep coal in the mix. Global warming legislation is coming down the pike. Carbon taxes, carbon caps, something is coming. The coal industry is trying to stay in the game in a carbon-constrained world. And they see gasification as a way to do that. And we also believe it's like if you've seen the movie Who Killed the Electric Car, and the way they talk about the hydrogen car is always dangled out there as this possibility at some point in the future that's maybe going to come to pass. And so in the meantime, we don't really have to do anything because we're working on the hydrogen car. We feel that same way about gasification and sequestration. It's this 20 or 30 years out, we promise coal is going to be totally clean. But for now, guess what's on the drawing boards nationwide? 150 new coal-fired power plants, the vast majority of which will not be gasification plants and have no hopes of sequestering the carbon dioxide. Our second big concern is it's going to have a disproportionate impact on the mountains that really can just not take any more and our communities that cannot take any more. The red line, the line at the top, is Appalachian coal reserves over the years. They are in decline, and as you can see in this slide, this is Energy Information Administration in the U.S. government. Any new mines in Appalachia are going to require more mountaintop removal, deeper mines. Basically, a National Academy of Sciences report came out recently and said the same thing. More mining, especially in the east, is going to have increasingly severe environmental consequences and increasingly unsafe conditions for miners. And if you build a new coal-fired power plant, you can't just get the coal from wherever you want all around the whole world. The railroads are how the coal is shipped, and the railroads mostly can't ship much more coal than they're already shipping, and people aren't building a whole lot more railroads, if you hadn't noticed. And so if you build a new coal plant in the east, you're locking in a new 50 to 100-year demand for coal right in the back door of the mountaintop removal region, and the pressure to get that coal through increasingly destructive, increasingly unsafe mining methods is just going to go up and up and up and up with every new coal plant that's built, especially in the eastern United States. Finally, this is a technical solution to a political problem, and the political problem is the unchecked power of the coal industry in our government. And ultimately, their objective is to get as much coal out of the ground as they can and burn it as cheaply as they can for as close to forever as they can. That is their job. And 30 years ago, we tried to solve this political problem, which was at that time strip mining, with the passage of the Surface Mining Act. And this is what we have in Appalachia 30 years later. Insane levels of strip mining. This is a picture of the harsh reality of what happens when the coal industry does their business according to our technical fixes. One coal company in Appalachia was just fined for violating the Clean Water Act over 6 years, 4,000 times. They were violating it 28 times a day. So even if this region, and even if mountaintop removal are not a priority for you, I would argue it's my closing point. The mountaintop removal is one of the most powerful wedges that we have in challenging the unchecked power of the coal industry, because people understand that this is not right. Just like the Exxon Valdez shined a light on the unchecked power of big oil, mountaintop removal shines a light on the unchecked power of big coal, and it's not something that many people are very aware of. People look out their window and they've heard about global warming, but everything is really fine. It doesn't seem like an immediate crisis in their life. They understand that this is not fine, that this is not okay, and we should not underestimate the public outrage that this kind of mining can generate and the public support for energy reform that it can generate and the public support for finally reining in big coal. So we would welcome the opportunity to work with everybody here on that. We definitely need your help. So thank you very, very much.
Marianne Hitt.
It's a great pleasure to introduce Jeff Goodall. He's also already been introduced very well by Marianne, so maybe I don't have to say a great deal more. But clearly his book, Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future, has been a classic book. It's been well recognized. It was chosen as one of the best nonfiction books of 2006 by Kirkus Reviews. He has also written a number of other books, and he's a contributing editor to Rolling Stone and a regular contributor, I gather, to the New York Times Magazine. Without any further ado, please welcome Jeff Goodall.
I want to talk about the sort of three myths that prop up the coal industry in America. And I'm really going to focus on America here. I know this conference is international, and coal is obviously a huge international issue, China and India and other places. But really, America is the sort of inflection point for it all, because, first of all, we have lots more coal than anybody else. We have a lot more than China. China's burning it twice as fast as us, but we have a lot more. And we're also the richest, most innovative country on Earth. And if we can figure out a way to deal with coal or get off coal, that is going to have a huge impact on the rest of the world. So I really think that the sort of technological and moral issues here in the U.S. are really central. And I'm going to talk about the three myths that sort of prop up our dependence on coal in America here, which is that it's clean, that it's cheap, and that it somehow helps with energy independence. And I'm going to go through them pretty briefly. But first I want to say that my perspective on this is totally different than Marianne's. I did not grow up in Appalachia. I grew up in California, in Silicon Valley. I worked at Apple Computer after college. I frankly had never seen coal until I was about 36 years old. I read about it. I thought, you know, coal was something that went out with top hats and corsets. It was something that you heard about in Charles Dickens novels and things. And I tell you this because I think I'm like a lot of Americans. I had no idea. We don't all live in Appalachia. We don't all live near coal plants. And even those of us who do don't really grasp what's going on. I mean, I had this vision that electricity just sort of poured down from a golden bowl in the sky. And, you know, I'd seen some wind turbines in California, a few places, and I'd seen a few hydroelectric dams. But I never really gave it any thought. You know, the electric bill came, I paid it, you know, whatever it was. It was not like gasoline where I was conscious of it and putting the pump in my car. I never gave it any thought. And this continued, as I said, until I was about 36 years old, when in the spring of 2001, my editor at the New York Times Magazine called and said, "Have you seen the Bush-Cheney energy plan? Looks like there's going to be a lot of coal in America's future. You know, why don't you go look into this?" And I hesitated for about 3 seconds, and I said, "Sure, why not?" And I didn't tell him that I didn't know that we were still burning coal at all, much less that it was going to be a big part of our future. So I jumped on an airplane and went to West Virginia and met with all the coal industry people like a responsible journalist does and heard all about how important it is for our prosperity and for our economic future and and, you know, learned about how it's half of our energy in America, half of our electricity in America, and how the coal plants are much cleaner than they used to be, and it's not your grandfather's industry, blah, blah, blah. And so I thought, oh, okay, interesting. Then I actually went out into the coal fields, and I actually started driving around, and it was a very bizarre experience for me because it's not like the West or a lot of places where you can get an easy perspective. It's very difficult to get a view of what's going on at these mines that you've seen so well illustrated here with Mary Ann's presentation. But eventually I saw a drag line above a mountain, and I climbed up and I looked down and I just saw what you saw there. But I saw it, and the ground was rumbling because it happened to be blasting. And I thought, oh my God, look at this. And then I started going around the coal fields, visiting towns and looking at the economic, seeing these broken towns, seeing this sort of devastation. I'm like, where is this prosperity that everybody's talking about? If this is coal brings prosperity, am I on the wrong road here? Did I miss it? That really opened my eyes. I realized then, hey, this is what's behind this whole iPod economy that I love. I mean, I worked at Apple. I'm a big, I believe deeply in technology as a way of solving problems, of progress, and all that. But I'd never thought about where these electrons that we all love to celebrate really come from. And when I got there to West Virginia, it really opened my eyes to that. And so I did the story for the Times, and then I decided to, after that I realized that I had just begun to touch the surface on this, and I decided to plunge into a book, which I spent 3 or 4 years, I don't ever tell anybody exactly how long because it's too depressing, how long I spent working on this book. And I came up with a lot of great factoids about average American burning 20 pounds of coal per day. That's how much we consume, but we don't ever know it because it comes in over the wire. But I really came to understand that it's really pretty simple that this whole coal dependence in America is propped up right now by three ideas. And that is, first, the idea that it's clean. And there's a lot of talk. A lot of Americans love the idea that we can use technology to make things better, that we can, clean coal is something like fat-free donuts or something. It's a slogan that we really want to believe in because we really want to be able to eat donuts and not get fat. And we really want to be able to burn coal and not have it destroy the planet. And we like that idea. And we think, oh, God, if we have iPods, we can have clean coal. But that is a complete myth, completely a focus grouped kind of phrase, advertising slogan. And I'm not going to go into the whole joke of clean coal when you look at just from the mining point of view. We saw that amply demonstrated here. But the industry will always talk about how emissions have dropped by 80%, say, since the 1970s when the Clean Air Act came in. And I want to just make two quick points about that. Is one, yes, that's true, but all the laws that forced them to do this, they fought kicking and screaming. And second of all, it applies to things like smog and things, the pollution that causes smog and things like that. But the things that we really care about right now, in fact, the thing that we care about most and is most important is carbon dioxide. And from a carbon dioxide point of view, coal plants are only marginally more efficient. And in fact, a lot of the CO2 emissions are going up from coal plants because we're burning more and more coal. And a lot of the so-called clean coal that we have burned in power plants has caused emissions to go up because the heat value in the coal is less, so you have to burn more of it. So from the things that we really care about, which is CO2, coal is not clean. And the technology that they have to go into the future is this thing called carbon capture and storage from coal gasification plants, which Mary Ann mentioned a little bit. And I'm not going to go into it in great detail. I'm happy to talk about it afterwards with anyone. But I think it is not going to work. I think it's a political tool. It's a way that from the very first time I started talking to people about the coal industry and how it works, I kept hearing from smart people in the industry who I really trusted about what's called delay and fail. That's the strategy for how this industry keeps thinks about new technology. Study it, study it, study it. Oh, it doesn't work. 20 years have gone by. Well, try this. Study it, study it, study it. 20 years. Meanwhile, you keep building the same thing, keep doing the same thing. And that, as I think, is what's going to go on with this idea of capturing and burying the carbon dioxide. The second thing, the second myth is this idea that it's cheap. It's cheap in the same way that fast food is cheap. It's cheap if you don't consider all the other consequences from eating a Big Mac a day. Yes, you can eat cheaply and have a Big Mac a day and you will not die of hunger. But you will get really fat and, you know, your skin will turn white and, you know, it'll destroy the planet and the sort of the effects on agriculture and all that kind of thing. It's a bad paradigm, right, for an agricultural economy. And it's a similar thing with coal. I mean, all this stuff that Marianne showed you, those are mountains. Those are externalities. They're not mountains. They don't have people living in them. They don't have animals. They don't have trees. They're externalities. And they're not factored into the cost of coal. My favorite thing about talking to coal industry guys and power industry guys is charts that show kilowatt hours price. They'll always show coal being here and gas being a little above and wind being a little above. And that's the whole context of the discussion. What is the kilowatt cost? And they really want to keep all the conversation right on that, not thinking about any of these other things like the mountains, like mercury emissions, like the fact that we're cooking the planet with coal. But I want to argue with this idea of cheap that it's over. Coal is no longer cheap. That's an idea of the past. We're starting to see that happen right now. And the thing that's driving that are a number of things, but the simplest thing that's driving it is carbon dioxide price. Everyone in America knows that there's going to be some kind of prices on carbon dioxide. We're going to hear more about this in just a minute, so I won't go into it. But the era of cheap coal is over. Everything about coal, from the cost of the power plants to the cost of the mining, Marianne talked about depletion, coal getting more deeply buried, more expensive to mine. Everything about the cost of coal is going up, 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 up. And everything about renewable energy is going down, 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 down. So you have two intersecting vectors here. And I think that they're about ready to cross right now. In fact, they probably have already crossed. And so the coal industry right now is really desperate to get a lot of mines open, power plants built, and all that before it becomes apparent to everybody else in the world that coal is a really expensive way to generate power, not a cheap way. And the last thing I want to touch on is this myth of energy independence. It's really crucial, and I know from talking to people that America's ignorance sort of about this matches my own prior to starting this, which is coal industry is doing a great job of exploiting the war in Iraq. They're doing a great job of saying, look, we have soldiers dying overseas. We need to get off of foreign oil. We can't support terrorists and all that. Without ever telling anybody in America that coal and oil have nothing to do with each other. Oil is used for various purposes, as you all know, and including transportation, mostly transportation. Coal is used for electricity almost exclusively in America. There is no coal right now used to replace oil. Now, the coal industry would really like to do this. They would like to get this thing called liquefied coal. They can make diesel fuel out of coal, and they would really like to get into America's gas tank. If there's any one aspiration, and maybe I think the biggest danger in going forward when thinking about, how quickly we're going to cook the planet, not whether we're going to, but how quickly, is this idea of liquefying coal. And the industry is, doing a great job of exploiting that right now, of exploiting our fears about the war in the Middle East. We have, the head of major companies like Peabody, talking about trying to get the military to guarantee a purchase of diesel fuel from coal, with the idea that we need this for national security because maybe we'll run out of oil and our fighter planes won't be able to fly, and so we at Peabody will save America by fueling the F-16s that will save us from, you know, God knows who's going to be flying over to bomb us. But that's the logic right now. And not only is that the logic, but they say we need $8 billion or whatever their latest number is in subsidies and tax breaks to do this. Because if we don't, you know, we might be vulnerable because we might run completely out of oil and our planes can't fly and we'll all be bombed. And you don't want that on your shoulders, do you? So give us our $8 billion and let us liquefy coal to make diesel for the military. And they really want to get their nose under that tent to get into, like I said, America's gas tank. And this is a disastrous idea for many, many reasons, but particularly from a climate point of view. It's twice as carbon intensive to make fuel out of coal than it is from petroleum, hugely water intensive. It's really a major step backwards in many ways. But that's what's going on. I was just in Alaska a couple of weeks ago to talk about coal up there. And this kind of economic blackmail that goes on in the industry is very powerful and very present. And I saw it up there where there's an electric co-op that's trying to build a coal plant. And they ran a full-page ad in the paper of a rat with an electric wire going by. And the rat had chewed through the electric wire, and there was an image behind of a city and blacked out. And all it said below it was, "Don't blame us." So there's always this logic that if we don't build this another power plant, if we don't build another coal-fired power plant, you know, the economy is going to collapse, the lights are going to go out, we're going to be like, you know, this is again a bad idea, I mean a bad metaphor, but like a bad comparison, like what happened in California, remember that? We're going to have rolling blackouts, we're going to have all these problems, America can't function if we don't burn lots of coal. And that is just the logic of a lot of the rhetoric about coal right now. And you see it very clearly in this stuff with the liquefied coal. And the fact is, we're at this great moment. We had this great tipping point. We have other ways to do it. This is not 1950, you know? There are ways of generating power that don't require coal. We have large-scale solar thermal stuff. We have wind. We have all kinds of things. We're getting very smart about energy. We don't need this 50s paradigm of just consume, 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 new coal plant, new coal plant, new coal plant, or America collapses is over. That's gone. But that's the ideology that is driving the coal industry and that we have to recognize and fight. Because I think we're at this great moment of creative change. I think that I spend a lot of time in Silicon Valley talking to the entrepreneurs there. You know, they really see coal as their enemy because they know that when we can get Americans and people in the world generally to wake up and see the dangers of this, that there'll be tremendous jobs, tremendous economic growth by replacing this aging 1920s infrastructure with smarter ways, cleaner ways, and cheaper ways of generating electricity. And I think that coal is one of the big blocks in before we can unleash that kind of economic and cultural kind of revolution. And just one last thing, and I'll get off the stage here, is that I think that just the key most important, simple one-line insight that I've come to is that no matter how you cut it, no matter how you spin it, no matter how you mine it, no matter what you do, no matter how fancy your technology is, I've looked at it from, you know, every way. The simple fact is that coal is the fuel of the past, not the future. And the sooner we recognize that, the sooner we get off that, the better we will all be. Thanks very much.
Jeff Goodall. You've been listening to a panel on false solutions from Confronting the Triple Crisis, a conference convened last September in Washington, D.C. by the International Forum on Globalization. For more information, visit ifg.org. More from the conference, as well as the next chapter of Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal, next week. You can download an MP3 of this and previous episodes of the show at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
Bible and the prophet's teaching.